Welcome to another episode of the Art Salon. My name is Nico Bejarano. Today we start a new series that is going to extend for a number of episodes with an old professor of mine called Susana Castellanos de Subiría. She is an expert in mythology of multiple cultures, and I'll read a quick biography, and then I'll explain why we're doing this series. So forgive me, I'm translating this biography in real time, so I'll do my best. Susana Castellanos is a writer and professor from Colombia that was born in Bogota. She did her undergraduate at the Pontificia Universidad Javeriana, and her thesis, The Witch, Verbalization of the Powers of the Earth, received an honorable mention, as along with the Autograph Prize. She is currently a professor at Universidad del Rosario, and also at my, you know, high school alma mater, Colegio Nagrará. She is one of my favorite people to discuss mythology because she is incredibly, incredibly knowledgeable. She's written extensively on a number of incredible subjects. I'll read a couple of her book titles so you get an idea of her interests. 2008, Perverse Women of History. 2009, Goddesses, Witches, and Vampires. 2015, Myths and Legends of the World, Take 1 and 2. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How the Devil Acquired His Horns in 2020. At any rate, her tastes are so eclectic, and I wanted to enlist her services, and we're going to have a series of conversations. We're going to start with Greek mythology. The idea behind this was that it has been my impression, talking to my peers, that their study of classics at university leave a lot to be desired. Maybe they didn't receive it to the degree that previous generations did, but this is a huge hole in any artist's, education. Because I believe that if you're an artist working in the West, you are infinitely poor if you did not read the Bible and do not have a basic grasp of Greek mythology. The reason for this is that if you visit the Met, if you go to the opera, if you go to the concert hall, And if you go to a rock concert, these myths, along with the Bible, are referenced and seem to be an obsession of mankind that if you have knowledge of them, make all of these cultural achievements richer, because then the artworks that you're looking at are a continuation of a really long tradition, and your immediate understanding of them gives you an in to understand these pieces better from the get-go. So we're talking things from Orpheus to who was Apollo, the many myths of transfiguration and metamorphosis that are so treated in ballet and in opera. And we're going to do this series, basically. This is the first one of the series where we start with Chaos and into the Titan era and the first generation of the Olympian gods. Susana's first language is not English, so you will notice, and I think you'll start getting in the groove of what she's talking about, and I stay with it. It's really great information that we talk about today. The materials that we discuss come from a number of original sources that I really hope that you go out and explore. Most of these are available online for free at things like Project Gutenberg. They're definitely, for obvious reasons, part of the public domain. So there's really no reason not to get into this. It's really exciting. And part of the thing that I hope you get from Susana is, for her, mythology is alive. She imparted to this to me in a way when I was studied with her as a young man in high school. Mythology, and if you can see the Bible that way, not so much as a dogmatic thing if you're not religious, but as part of our myths, it is something more than literature. These people, these gods, they're alive, and that's how they were for the people that wrote music. That's Prometheus seemed alive to Beethoven when he wrote in his honor, and these deities were alive to Virgil and to Milton, and obviously to Shakespeare. There's something more than fiction, and that's why they're important to us. They represent our dreams, our hopes, our many personalities. They represent humanity. So the source materials that I recommend the most are the Homeric Hymns by Hesiod. The one we treat most in this episode is Theogony. You can read Theogony in, an hour, maybe. It is hard language to some degree, but not impossible. I think it's very doable. With that, I will leave you with this first of our series of Greek mythology. But before doing so, I will read the opening of Theogony so you get an understanding and a feeling for the language that somebody like Hesiod used. And this is from the translation from Hugh G. Evelyn White. From the Heliconian Muses, let us begin to sing, who told the greatest and holy mount of Helicon, and dance on soft feet about the deep blue spring and the altar of the almighty son of Cronos. And when they have washed their tender bodies in Permassus, or in the horse's spring, or Olmius, make their fair, lovely dances upon highest Helicon, and move with vigorous feet. Thence they rise and go abroad by night, veiled in thick mist, and utter their songs with lovely voice, praising Zeus, the aegis holder, and queenly Hera of Argos, who walks on golden sandals, and the daughter of Zeus, the aegis holder, bright-eyed Athene, and Phoebus Apollo, and Artemis, who delights in arrows, and Poseidon, the earth holder, who shakes the earth, and reverend Themis, and quick-glancing Aphrodite, and Hebe with the crown of gold, and fair Dione, Leto, Lipitas, and Cronos, the crafty counselor, Eos, and great Helios, and bright Selene, earth too, and great Oceanus, and dark Night, and the holy race of all the other deathless ones that are forever. And one day they taught Hesiod glorious song, while he was shepherding his lambs under holy Helicon. And this word first the goddesses said to me, the Muses of Olympus, daughters of Zeus, who hold the aegis. Shepherds of the wilderness, wretched things of shame, mere bellies, we know how to speak many false things as though they were true, but we know, when we will, to utter true things. So said the ready-voiced daughters of great Zeus, and they plucked and gave me a rod, a shoot of sturdy laurel, a marvelous thing, and breathed into me a divine voice to celebrate things that shall be and things there were aforetime. And they bade me sing of the race of the blessed gods that are eternally, but ever to sing of themselves both first and last. But why all this about oak and stone? Come thou, let us begin with the Muses, who gladdened the great spirit of their father Zeus in Olympus with their songs, telling us of things that are, and that shall be, and that were aforetime with consenting voice. Unwearying flows the sweet sound from their lips, and the house of their father Zeus, the loud thunderer, is glad at the lily-like voice of the goddesses as it spreads abroad, and the peaks of snowy Olympus resound, and the homes of the immortals. And they, uttering their immortal voice, celebrate in song first of all the reverend race of the gods from the beginning, those whom earth and wide heaven begot, and the gods sprung of these, givers of good things. Then next, the goddesses sing of Zeus, the father of the gods and men, as they begin and end their strain, how much he is the most excellent among the gods and supreme in power. And again, they chant the race of men and strong giants and gladden the heart of Zeus within Olympus, the Olympian Muses, daughters of Zeus the aegis holder. This is how the poem starts, and I hope that you take it on and read it either before or after you hear this episode. Hopefully what we discuss here in this episode will make the words of Hesiod easier to understand. And with that, I leave you with Susana Castellanos. I met Susana when I was going to school, and it was a great treat, because she's not just a school professor, she's a college professor and like one of the great experts in mythology that I've ever met. And more than an expert, I think what I really like is you give a great love for mythology. That's a thing that I hold on to, is that it feels alive for you. And you remind me of something that a friend of mine, Andres Caro, says, that there's things that are more elevated than fiction. Like for him, the Bible, we're both atheists, but it's alive in a different way. And I think mythology of all sorts is alive in a different way. Like I sort of live thinking that Zeus and Cronos and all are real people, even though they don't matter and they're not real, if that makes sense. And I got that, I think, a lot from you because they feel alive for you. So, we were talking before, I just want to, like, this episode is also for artists because I think that a lot of classical education is not as good as it used to be. People used to learn these classical things all the time in education, but they're not so much anymore. So it's something that's been requested, and I thought you could be important for this. And part of it is what you and I have talked about, that you need to know in the West Greek mythology or Roman mythology and the Bible if you want to really appreciate like 99% of art that has come from the West. So I guess we can start there, and I don't know, like, tell me why we should learn Greek mythology in the 21st century, why it should still be important for like a classic education.
Well, I think artistic reinterpretation of mythology, particularly Greek and Roman mythology, plays a vital role in how these stories have become to be viewed and understood. For example, works such as Botticelli's The Birth of Venus have become permanent extensions of classic mythological stories and figures. As art defined mythology, mythology subsequently left its impact on art. With the endless potential for reinterpretation, the stories, figures, and symbols of mythology provide artists with a vast source of symbolic material. As a result, mythology is constantly mutating to best suit the artist's need to express themselves. As disconnected from reality as mythology may seem, just beneath the surface of the fantastical stories lies universal truths of the human condition. Through the exploration of intrinsically human themes, mythology becomes a means to understand the world with philosophical inquiry, leaving artists to turn off the fantastical stories to process the truth of their realities.
Okay.
More or less.
No, that's, yeah. I mean, that's amazing. And I think, for me, with what you said, like Greek mythology and Norse mythology and Egypt and everything, but specifically Greek, is so amazing because, and this is maybe something we should talk about before we get into the whole subject, is that the way that the Greek mythology works and everything is very different from Christian religion or religion in general. And that's what makes it so amazing for a subject for art, because unlike the claim in Christianity that we are made in the image of God, what becomes apparent by reading Greek mythology is that the gods are made in the image of man. And so it becomes this way to interpret and live humanity and deep, important lessons through a fun, or not even necessarily a fun, but a valuable lesson that we can take with us. And the embodiment of specific traits of humanity in each of these gods, which I think is very unique to Greek mythology specifically, maybe because it's so elaborate. I don't know, what do you think?
Yes, definitely. Mythology helps you to understand the self. You know, the Freudian interpretation of classical mythology became a persuasive subject among artists looking to examine the self, reaching its height in the mind. And the tale of Theseus, who conquered the depths of the labyrinth by slaying the Minotaur, particularly resonate with Surrealists, for example. And Surrealists overtook the depiction of the Cretan saga with a psychological perspective, rooted in Freudian psychology, as man's journey traveling through the labyrinth representative the mind to reach in its depths, or the inner psyche after conquering the Minotaur symbolic of the id. André Masson's fascination with the Minotaur in multiple works, for example, is believed to be responsible to the resurgence of the Minotaur and its psychoanalytic interpretations in the 20th century art. Pablo Picasso, you know, had a special relationship with the Minotaur, which explores the unconscious with, the, of course, great Freudian influence. It means beyond the traditional religion and its relation with mythology, you can understand the spirituality of the self through the myths.
Yeah, and it's such I mean, I think as we go through these and each god, as you know, in the series, I think that becomes so apparent. I mean, we'll get to it, but for example, just as a primary, like my favorite thing in the world in mythology, in Greek mythology, is the fact that Athena is born in full armor. And again, you're talking about like the symbology of this is, it's so amazing that knowledge has to be born fully armed to defend itself. And this is the type of thing that I think is so fruitful for artists and why, like you said, you can go to Pablo Picasso in 1930, he's obsessed with this, but also Schiller is talking about it, and also the Renaissance painters are talking about it. And it seems to touch very deep, and also because even though it's part of our inheritance, it's not, it's sacred in a different way for us, Greek mythology, but it can be talked about and explored much more than the Catholic myth or the Catholic religion until recently. I think, of course, Freud and everyone has been talking about Christ and all this, but we have way more centuries of people talking about Greek mythology as you're describing it, like psychologically or artistically or symbolically. And so I think, I mean, we can jump into it, but I think that this is why it's so important for me. When you go to a museum and you see a random painting with a woman with an owl, you're much better off knowing that that is possibly Athena or Minerva and that that's what the painting's about. Or the many statues, the Metropolitan Museum, you can't go there without knowing it. So much symbology that has been obsessive. And I think we need to keep that alive because it's a very interesting and full topic and subject. And like you said, a wealth of stories and everything for artists to continue to reimagine and reinterpret and rediscover, no?
Yes. For example, from the Midas touch to a Sisyphean task, from Pandora's box to Achilles' heel, characters from classical Greek and Roman mythology have an inescapable presence in everyday life and language. Their stories have been continually retold across all forms of culture, in novels, poems, and plays, in music, from opera to pop songs, and in every type of visual arts, from ancient painting and sculpture to installations and video art today.
Yes, it's super rich, no? And so I think we should start with, let's set everyone up, because I think a lot of people, when they think of Greek mythology, they think of Olympian gods, and there's everything that leads to Olympus is also very important, especially in what we're talking about with symbology and everything else. So before we started recording, we were talking about this thing that I finally made this connection, or maybe remade it after all these years, that going to the Olympians, so that means Zeus and all the gods that people know, the Greeks before that have all these kind of forces, no? Or nature that is forming into something else but is not necessarily reasonable. They continue to exist throughout time. But let's talk about how the Greeks viewed kind of the beginning of the universe and the first immortals. And we can do that briefly on our way to discover kind of the pre-Olympians, which are the Titans. So what should we... What is the most important things that people should know about this myth, and where can they find versions of it? I think that's another important thing. So For me, my favorite is Hesiod, the Homeric poems, the Theogony. But I'll let you go since you're the expert.
Okay, the Titans were the pre-Olympian gods who ruled the cosmos in the ancient Greek mythology before the Titanomachy War. They were giant, immortal deities and considered the first generational gods born from the primordial forces, from the primordial gods. Uranus and Gaia, they ruled from the Otris, not the Olympus. They lived in the Otris, and each god had its realm to rule over. The Titans were different to gods because they were forces. They were between forces and the intellectual side. You know, that make the Titans different. The Titans were not bad. They were pre-Olympian. And they were, you know, like strong forces from nature. And that's the reason why many times they are showed as evil, but they are not evil, really. They are just more instintivos, you know?
Yeah, like they instinctive, right? No, so this is a question I had actually in preparation for this. This is interesting. So, but they're sort of in between the Olympians. So you end up with somebody like Zeus, no? Which is the god of the heavens and the thunder and all this. But Zeus is not the thunder. Whereas Cronos, his father, is somewhere in between. He's sort of time, but he's also sort of a person, no?
It's really interesting. Why are you asking for? Because Zeus has the power over the thunder. He incarnates the thunder, but with intelligence. You know what I mean? Because he didn't make the turns. The giants made the turns, you know?
Yeah, the giants made the thunder for him, no?
Yeah.
As a weapon.
They made the thunder. Yeah. It means Zeus can control the thunder. He's not the thunder.
Right.
And that's different with the primordial forces, because the primordial forces were the sky, you know, they are the things from the nature, and the development means that now they are more intelligent and they can control the forces of nature.
So the Titans are como in a sandwich in between. The Olympian
exactly.
gods that
exactly.
are not the thing, but they're
exactly.
also not primordial ideas. There's something in between. They're both an entity and an idea, sort of.
Yeah, the Titans were gigantic, powerful, ancient beings that loomed in the background of many Greek myths and tales, you know? And they are not exactly gods, but they are closer to the nature, and not just the nature, like outside the people, the human nature, you know, they means all that you are with your instinct, you know, but for example, the justice is in your instinct too, you know, it's not just, for example, not just Cronus, you know, it's Hyperion, it's Lapetus, and there are female too, Thetis, Themis, Mnemosyne, Prometheus. He's a son of Titans, but it's usually considered as a Titan too. Atlas, and they are more forces, but with sense of justice, you know, with some sense of measure, because Cronos is the time. And time is measured. Entonces, he has the estaciones.
Oh, the seasons, yes.
Exactamente.
Yes, entonces, so like you're saying, so there's the Titans are both things in a way, but this is where we start getting actual, like, interesting narrative stories, no? because these titans also start having personalities. Like, my feeling when I read Theogony is that Gaia and Uranus and all this, they don't really have a personality. They just are. But then Cronos, Oceanus, I mean, the little bit they talk about them, but Hyperion, Iapetus, they all have personalities and missions. So they are the ones that really kind of begin the stories that you start seeing depicted in a lot of art and a lot of they're the ones that get talked a lot. You see Hyperion referenced constantly, for example, in Shakespeare, and I think when we start talking, we'll talk about Cronos and Uranus and Aphrodite. Like, that's a very depicted thing, but you don't see so many depictions of Gaia, for example.
No, because she's the Earth, you know. But there are major myths of the Titans. The most tales of the Titans involve the overthrow of their father Uranus and their own battle against the Olympian gods. Uranus hated the children born from his wife Gaia, so he forced her to keep the Titans in Tartarus.
Which is a recurring theme. This is another thing, like, it's a recurring theme in Greek mythology, you know? So Uranus and Gaia are the forces, and they give birth to the Titans. And you're saying Uranus hated his children.
Exactly. Exactly. He felt some passion, you know, hate. This caused Gaia much pain, and she asked her sons to help her defeat Uranus by cutting off his genitals with a sickle. Only her youngest son, Cronus, was willing to do it. After he was successful, the Titans were freed from Tartarus and ruled the heaven. Cronus, with his sister Rhea at his side, was their leader. However, Cronus was told that when he had children, one of his sons would overthrow him, just as he had done to his own father. To avoid this fate, Cronus swallowed each of his children as soon as they were born. Rhea managed to save only one child, Zeus, by hiding him and feeding Cronus a stone in the baby's place.
Just for people that don't know. So basically, Cronus, which you're talking about, marries or has children with Rhea, which are the Olympian gods, like you're saying. And the ones that he ate are, in order, Hestia, Poseidon, Hera, Demeter, and Hades?
Yeah.
Okay, so those are Zeus's brothers. And then he's eating all of this, and I think my favorite, for anyone that wants to look it up, it's so visceral, the Goya painting of Saturn devouring his kids. It's amazing. So he's eating all his children because his mom told him that he was also destined to be dethroned. And so now you were saying Rhea hides Zeus, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. When Zeus grew older, he gave his father a potion that made him vomit out his other siblings. Those children know as the Olympian. They wage an 11-year war against the Titans. The Olympians eventually won and cast many of the Titans back into Tartarus, where Uranus had imprisoned them long before. However, several of the Titans, including Oceanus and all the female Titans, did not participate in the war against the Olympians, and therefore were able to remain free.
Yes, and so let's... two things are very interesting for me about Greek mythology that are important for understanding, like, the art that comes out of this as well. That one thing that's very interesting for me about Greek mythology is this idea that gods cannot kill gods, and they also can't invalidate their actions. And so it's fascinating that they kept this logic that he ate his children, but because they're immortal, they couldn't die, even though he ate them. So that's how they can be thrown up and still be alive. I find that super fascinating. And it's also a recurring theme that immortality is not necessarily a positive thing. I mean, we can, the other character here that we'll talk about later is Prometheus, that is also very pictured throughout art. But I like that a lot about Greek mythology, this idea that one god and one force of nature cannot really destroy another one. And uh-huh. and so basically in this war, like you're saying, that's finally when the Olympians win and everything else. But yeah. if I can go back one second, I would like you to tell us the story since she's so pictured, because Aphrodite is seen as an Olympian, sort of, but she doesn't come from this family. She's not the son of Cronos and Rhea. So can you tell me about her origin?
Yeah, of course. Well, it was when Cronos cut the genitals to
his father.
Uranus. Yeah, to his father. Fall to the sea, and that's the way that Aphrodite born, you yes. know. And it's really interesting because the piece of art, the Birth of Venus, is exactly after that, you know. It means the Greek poet Hesiod recounts in his epic Theogony that Aphrodite was born from the white foam produced by the severed genitals of Uranus, the personification of heaven after his son Cronus threw them into the sea. That's the way that yes. Uranus, you know, Cronus castrated
his
Uranus
father, no?
And threw his father's testicles into the sea. They caused the sea to foam, and out of what white foam rose Aphrodite, the goddess of love and beauty.
So you can recognize, this is typical, like you can recognize Aphrodite. I mean, the most obvious is the Botticelli Venus, but there's a lot of them. And you can recognize because the scene is always surrounded by water, there's always foam, and she emerges fully formed. Which is another, I think it's another thing about Greek deities that I find interesting. Some grow up, some don't. And the ones that are just born fully formed are usually women, no? So,
definitely.
So Aphrodite, very important, but I just wanted to point her out because she then ends up in Olympus with basically what would be her nephews or something like that. She was like their aunt.
And it's interesting too because it's like she's still alive. After, you know, the primary culture that many scholars think was matriarchal. Some scholars suggest that the reign and ultimate defeat of the Titans in Greek mythology reflects the conquest of an early culture by the one we know associated with the ancient Greece. This earlier culture is believed to have been matriarchal, meaning women held the primary positions on power within the society. This is suggested by the Titans' close association with their mother, Gaia, and poor relationship with the father, Uranus. The ancient Greece being a patriarchal society where men held most power were similar to the Olympian gods who take control of the heavens. The regions of the world would be divided among the three sons, Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades, while the daughters were not given direct rule over anything. If this idea is correct, the myth of the ancient Greek could be a direct reflection of ancient cultural clashes in the region.
I will totally believe that theory, also especially because eventually, when other gods like Dionysus show up, it's also a culture clash that happened in ancient Greece between the kind of philosophical logician school and this mystical desire of the general population. So I think that that's another thing that's interesting about Greek mythology, is that it evolves and it adopts things as the society also changes, and it's a reflection of the society and its desires and preoccupations.
Yeah, the Greek mythology is full of symbols, you know. The Titans represent huge, primitive, hard to control forces. Indeed, many of the Titans are embodiments of the forces of nature and born of the Mother Earth. they also symbolize a spirit of rebellion against the authority of the gods, as in the story of the Titan Prometheus, who helped women, human beings against Zeus' will.
Yes, that's my favorite. That's, I think, my favorite. Pero, so walk me through, let's talk quickly like about the most important titans that actually matter, because some of them, I mean, they all matter, but I feel like some of them are more important throughout Western civilization. Like Mnemosyne is the kind of power and goddess of memory, so that's important. What are some of the other ones? Obviously, Cronos we talked about, but what are the ones that survive after just being like, oh yeah, the Titans got defeated by Olympus? Like, what are the ones that stay with humanity very strongly?
All stay, you know. Themis, the justice, you know, the justice is still Mnemosyne. She's the mother of the muses. She's the memory. Yeah, they are the most important. Well, Cronos is the time, and the Rhea is the, it's in many ways las cosechas.
Oh, the harvest. But, yeah.
Yeah, but it's in many ways the earth too. You know, it's both things.
Okay.
As Aphrodite is the fertility. Yeah.
And we know which ones become very influential also later when Zeus starts having sex with all of them. But I will come back to Iapetus because he's the father of Prometheus.
Uh-huh.
But let's go back now to the Olympians, no?
Sí.
So they win the war, whatever. That's fantastic. And I think people can read about it. The Theogony is very easy. But let's talk about their personalities and like their appearance in art. I'm particular. So we have Hestia, Poseidon, Hera, Demeter, and Hades, and Zeus. Zeus is probably the most written about in that we have original sources for, no? But but I the one that interests the one I want to start with, because it's the most interesting for me from an art perspective, is why don't we start with Poseidon, because we actually don't have that much historical como mythology of Poseidon, but he appears all the time in the Iliad, which is probably the most important book of fiction of the ancient world, no?
Okay, it's really interesting for me. Okay.
No, but I mean, am I wrong? Como what I remember when I read is that Poseidon is just mentioned, but then he plays this central role in the Iliad, and becomes a character. So more so than I'm the god of the ocean, and here's what I do. And it's what interests me is like why he becomes important to artists afterwards, like starting with with Homer, because it's like it's weird that he forms kind of a central role in the. So actually, instead of focusing just on Poseidon, let's talk about each of the personalities of the Olympian gods.
Okay,
that's a better way to go about it.
Poseidon was the only Olympian god who had access to the watery depths. He could plumb deeply and stay under the sea as long as he wants, you know, because he's the king. Our rice supplied to the surface merely by commanding his golden-maned steeds who pulled his chariot and could have the creatures of the deep frolic around him, a scuba diver's dream. Poseidon is also a metaphor for the man or woman who can go deeply into the realm of feeling and emotions and gain access to what is down there, soul and sorrow, great beauty and monsters of the deep, places so deep and so dark that clear vision is no longer possible and one can only dimly sense what is there. Here is a sense of vastness, far greater than one can either plumb or fully know.
So he's a very emotional.
Absolutely.
God.
Absolutely. You know, like Zeus, It's a leader, but in a different way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's really passionate. He's emotional, you know? The trident bearer is the Poseidon symbol. And it means, it's interesting because Poseidon's symbol was the trident, a phallic symbol that, along with the meaning of his name, Husband of Earth, places him historically as a pre-Olympian god, a consort of the great goddesses, you know? And he's really symbolic. He's older than Zeus, because the waters are ancient than Zeus, you know? And Poseidon is the implacable enemy. The story of Poseidon, you know, he's all the time trying to make justice in his own way, you know. It's different than Zeus, because Zeus is the authority. Poseidon always wants to do everything in his own way, you know. That makes Poseidon as the archetype of the wild man. You know, that makes it really interesting.
He's also, I always thought of him, like, even though he's not, like, Zeus is the youngest, he has, like, he has young child syndrome, no? Como, he wants people to love him, but they don't pay attention to him because they're busy, and he wants to be number one, but he's not number one. It's kind of like people like him, but they don't. He's not first thought to the Greek people. So that's always how I've interpreted Poseidon. That's why I think he's so fascinating. Como, he's very powerful, but people forget he's powerful. And he destroys cities, but then it doesn't help him that he destroyed the city. He sides with the wrong person on the Trojan War. He's kind of a tragic figure, no?
Definitely, yes. Poseidon, the man, Poseidon's sphere is the realm of emotions, and the man for whom Poseidon is the archetype is directly in touch with his instincts and feelings, which he expresses spontaneously and immediately if he is extroverted, and may harbor within if he is introverted. In either case, he feels deeply and intensely. And he grows up in a culture that prefers boy and men to be unemotional. That's the reason why it's really important today, you know, to see, to understand this god and its archetype.
Yes. So he's great. And you see him, like I said, I think the Iliad is probably the place you can see him the most if you want to see the personality. So we cut Poseidon. Let's go then to, let's start with the boys, because I also, interestingly, we'll get to Hestia, because Hestia is its own mess. But interestingly, we know a lot more about Hera and Demeter than we know about Hades, for example. Like, we know what he does, but he only really appears prominently in the myth of Persephone, and everything else we have to put together through little bits, no?
Okay, Hades is really, really interesting, you know. Let me know, what do you think about Hades? Because many people watch Hercules. What do you remember? What do you think about Hades?
I like the interpretation of him in that Disney movie in one way, which is... I don't like that they make him so evil, but if you are an adult, you realize that he's not evil. He's just like, he's unlucky. One of the things that is explained in the Homeric hymns in Hesiod is that when the Titans win the war, the men divide where they're going to live, and luck, which is its own god type of thing, the series of gods, they decide that Zeus gets... everyone wants to be in the heaven, but they decide, okay, Zeus gets the heaven, and then they raffle again, and Poseidon gets the sea, and so the loser is Hades, but it's not his fault. Like, he's a nice guy, he wants a good life, but he gets stuck living in the worst place. There's no light. Nobody wants to go there. Nobody can go there because that's one of the rules. So my interpretation of Hades, the little we know about him, is just that he's like, he got the bad hand, but he's not a bad guy.
Exactly. Hades is the Greek god of the underworld, you know?
Which is different than hell, no?
Yes, that's other conversation.
Yeah, that's fine.
They don't have exactly hell, you know? Because you have to pay your sins in this life, not in hell. And Hades is the ruler of the dead in Greek mythology, but he should not be thought of as the devil or Satan. Hades is a stern, grim, and his decisions are final, but he is not a tempter, evil, or an enemy of mankind. Hades presides over the darkest hour of life, depressions, anxiety, emotional dramas, and grief. But he is not evil, you know? A person becomes familiar with Hades when they descend into his world, a place which makes one feel cut off from reality, lonely and depressed. Here there is no desire to feel the sunlight or closeness of other people. The realm of Hades is in the unconscious, both the personal and the collective unconscious. It is the place where much is represented, memories, feelings, thoughts, everything, you know, could be painful, shameful, or unacceptable to allow the visible world to see or know about those yearnings or dreams. It's interesting because we need to go deep many times. We don't want to stay there all the time, but we need to see our dark side, you know? It's not evil side, it's just dark.
Yes, and also I think maybe we'll talk about it quick, like we'll come back to this today, but I think something you said you helped me make a connection that Hades is, maybe that's why we don't have that much story about Hades except, you know, the story of Orpheus and the story of Persephone, which are both about travels. But a very important thing, like you said, like Hades, both the god, but also where he resides, is inflexible. And it's it's almost like you cannot really live there. Like a lot of the stories are basically saying, like, if you go to this place, if you are attracted to this thing, you can never come back to the world of the living. And so the connection I made is that maybe that's why he's not a god that seems as alive as Poseidon or Hera or Athena.
And the Greeks didn't want to talk about him. He didn't have a temple, for example. Nobody wants to talk about him. Hades was a son of Cronus and Rhea, who was swallowed at birth by Cronus, who feared his sons would become greater than he. Wise Metis helped Zeus to make a special potion that caused Cronus to regurgitate the children he swallowed. When brothers Hades and Poseidon joined Zeus to fight against Cronus and the Titans, they won. And after the victory, drew lots to divide the world. Hades' portion was the underworld. He didn't like it, but the fates, the destiny, decided. And the fates, the destiny, are more powerful than the Olympian gods. Hades fathered no children and spent all his time unseen in the underworld. only leaving it twice, according to Homer. Heracles wounded Hades with an arrow, and he had to go to Mount Olympus for aid. His more significant departure was when he abducted Persephone, and that's his biggest history on the earth, you know? The story of Hades and Persephone, and she became the queen of the underworld. The rape of Persephone is Hades' central myth. He deeply wanted her to be his bride, so he kidnapped her with Zeus' consent while she was gathering flowers in a meadow with other maidens. She parted from the turn to pick a beautiful 100-flowered narcissus created to lure her to Hades when she reached out to pick it. The ground beneath her opened up and Hades came out on a vent in the earth in his chariot, pulled by strong blood horses. Hades sighted the terrified Persephone, who screamed for Zeus, her father, but he ignored her pleas. They descended deep into the underworld, and the earth closed up as if nothing had happened. But after a few times, Persephone really enjoyed to be the queen of the underworld, and she loved Hades.
Yeah, and Persephone comes up a lot. I think she's a very interesting character also in art. And even recently, I thought it was very interesting. Like, she comes up even in the Matrix trilogy as a character, and it's that complicated thing, like you're saying, she's an unwilling bride, but then at the end of the day, I mean, she ends up married with one of the three strong men, so, you know, not so bad.
Yeah, Persephone was really depressed during some time in the underworld, and her mother Demeter, you know, the relation between Persephone and Demeter is really, really complicated.
So to clarify, Demeter is the sister of another one of the Olympians, and she's the sister of Zeus and Poseidon and Hades.
Yeah.
And their daughter, his daughter is Persephone.
Yeah. And the father of Persephone is Zeus, mm-hmm. You know? It means Zeus has relations with...
everyone.
with Demeter and with Hera. Both were... his sisters. Mm-hmm. You know, Demeter was besides, you know, Persephone, Demeter raged and cried, but when she were wedded to her temple, no crops grew, no new babies were born, and no new life any kind sprang up. You know, that's the power of Demeter. Because Demeter continues with Rhea's power, you know? Demeter has the power of the earth. In the same way that first became Uranus, Cronus, and Zeus, with the power of the heaven, mm-hmm. The earth were Gaia, Rhea, and Demeter. Well, in this situation, Zeus gave in to Demeter's demands and sent Hermes to bring Persephone back. Persephone was overjoyed that Hermes came to her rescue, but she loves Hades too. You know, Persephone has an interesting duality between her husband and her mom. And that has a strong actuality. You know, many times the people is in this situation. And Demeter then allowed new life to spring about and bring greenness back to Earth. The situation could have ended there if Persephone did not eat anything while in the underworld. But when Hades tricked her into eating pomegranate seeds, it sealed her fate to spend the winter months of the year as Hades' consort, while the earth lies fallow.
So this is one of the... So there's the complicated mythologies, there's a lot of powerful people, but this is one of the main explanations for the seasons, no? So like Persephone comes back. We know Persephone's back with her mother when it's spring and it's summer, and when it's time to go back to Hades in this joint custody, it's fall and winter. No?
Exactly.
So I mean, that's the multi-layered part of Greek mythology that's so amazing. Porque these are two people with human desires, but they also control everything. And it's very fascinating. So Persephone, and one thing that you mentioned about this story that's important, that will be important for later when we talk about Orfeo, is this idea that it's not so easy to leave Hades. Like, this is the one place, it's very difficult to enter Olympus, but you can, like, theoretically you could leave Olympus, but it's very impossible to leave Hades. There's a bargain made when you die, no?
Yeah. Just few heroes like Hercules, Orpheus, and Odysseus went to Hades and came back because they are heroes, you know? But the normal people just go there and stay there, you know?
And even gods, no? See, Hermes is one of the few gods that goes into Hades ever.
Yeah, he can go and come back because he symbolized, you know, the bold worlds.
Right.
Hermes symbolized the ambiguity in everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we talked about Demeter, which is, again, the seasons, this kind of mother, the Pachamama, as we like the mother of things, the controller of the seasons. Like you said, it symbolizes both good maternity and bad maternity. And the devouring mother that destroys everything because she's alone and all these things. Let's talk about her. She has two other sisters of the Olympians. One is Estia, which Estia is very complicated. It has always been very complicated for me because she's like not a person. No, it's kind of weird. So tell
because Estia.
I mean, I think Estia, what I remember from my classes is she's so important. Because she's kind of the epitome of the virginal goddess, even though there will be other virginal goddesses later. She is she's kind of like so pure and so perfect and all this. And she represents the home and the hearth. And she's gifted by Zeus because Zeus is having sex with everything and Estia doesn't want it. And Zeus is so impressed that he... kind of gives her an extreme honor, no? Because by being the goddess of the home and the hearth, what I remember, and you'll have to correct me, what I remember is she's present everywhere. That's why there is fire in the temple. She precedes every other god. All the sacrifices have to go to her. But on the other hand, this is why she's confusing to me. Estia has very little stories. Estia is not interesting. Estia is not human.
Exactly. She's more, in many ways, she's more a symbol, but she's a goddess. You know, she's the virgin goddess. And Estia was the oldest of the three virgin goddesses. Unlike Artemis and Athena, she did not venture outside into the world to explore the wilderness or establish a city. She stayed inside house or temple, contained within the heart. On the surface, anonymous Hestia seems to have a little in common with quick-to-act Artemis or with keen-minded golden-armored Athena. Yet essential intangible qualities were shared by all the three virgin goddesses. However, different their spheres of interest of mothers of action. Each had the one in herself quality that characterized a virgin goddess. No one was victimized by male deities or mortals. Each had the ability to focus on what mattered to them and concentrate on that without being distracted by the needs of others or by the needs for others. Yeah.
So she's like the model for more interesting goddesses like Artemis and Athena, who have more role to play in humans' lives. But like you said, I think what is important is to understand that the virginal thing, what inherits is what you're saying, which is focus on your mission. Yes?
Yeah.
And Contrasted with that is her sister, Hera, which is this the wife of Zeus, which she's very interesting in mythology, but she's also, you might be able to answer, like, did anyone ever worship Hera for anything other than fear? Es decir, como, I don't know if anyone liked her, but everyone was afraid of her, no?
All the wives love Hera. Maybe you can't understand that.
No, but... because when I read, I find, so Hera, which is the wife of Zeus, represents, I'll tell you what I remember. She represents like, the wife, no? And the mother in that nurturing way, the family, the construction of a family. But in the mythology, 90% of the time when she appears, she's just being the complicated person, no?
Definitely, yeah. Yes.
And with good reason. So tell us about Hera and what she represents, and why is she entitled to be the actual official wife of Zeus? Because Zeus is having sex with everyone, but she's the official wife, no?
Definitely. She's the third wife, but she's the official wife. It's not the first one, you know? Mm-hmm. That's interesting, too. Yeah, but she's the archetype of marriage, you know? And it's interesting because Hera, as goddesses of marriage, was revered and reviled, honored, and humiliated, you know? She, more than any other goddesses, had markedly positive and negative attributes. The same is true for the Hera archetype, an intensely powerful force for joy or pain in a woman personality, you know? That's really interesting for me because it's a real archetype, you know. The Hera archetype first and foremost represents a woman's yearning to be a wife. A woman with a strong Hera archetype feels fundamentally incomplete without a partner. She's motivated by a goddess-given instinct toward marriage. Her grief at being without a male can be as deep, as wounding an inner experience as being childless. It's for a woman whose strongest urge is to have a baby. You know, as a queen, of Mount Olymp, Hera is powerful, you know? But as she has a dark side, she has a strong capacity for commitment. Mm. And she is really interesting.
Is she also interested in power, Susana? Because wouldn't she have been more happy being married to Hades? Because he would have been very, very committed and nice.
Yes, but when she decides that she wants to be against Zeus, because
she's had enough, no?
Yeah, that's enough. And she decides that she's going to be against Zeus. And the only time that Zeus really has in risk his power was because Hera. And despite of she has a strong capacity for commitment, she can destroy you too, you know? That's really interesting because all the gods have both sides. She can give you everything or she can kill you too, you know? You don't need one god to be protect, you know? But if you need that, but if he's mad at you, he can destroy you, you know? The Hera archetype provides the capacity to bond, to be loyal and faithful, to endure and go through difficulties with a partner. That's really interesting. When Hera is a motivating force, a woman's commitment is not conditional. Once married, she means to stay so, for better or worse. Without Hera, a woman may go through a series of short-lived relationships, moving on when the inevitable difficulties arise or the initial magic of failing in love wears off. She may never marry and may feel quite fine about her unmarried state. That's interesting because she is going to stay there forever, you know?
So how is her relationship with Aphrodite in Olympus?
It's interesting because Aphrodite never sleep with Zeus, you know?
But she's the opposite, no? She thinks it's very frivolous. Aphrodite is very frivolous about love to the point, I mean, we'll talk about that later, but to the point that the gods decide it's enough with Aphrodite and they make her fall in love so that she understands how terrible the game she plays, no? So I'm asking, does Hera care about Aphrodite or no?
Not really, okay. Not really, but they are different, but they are not. Hera is not mad at Aphrodite, no? It's okay with Aphrodite. It's more difficult for her, all the Zeus lovers, you know?
Which were so many. I think one other thing, like, I want to talk about a couple things with Hera that are important in art, but another thing I find interesting is that her children with Zeus are the most unremarkable of the of the children, no? It's Hephaestus, which is ugly, very useful, but very ugly. And Ares, which is different than Mars in Roman mythology, because Mars is more like Athena, but Ares is more like the bloodthirsty combat.
Definitely.
He's a terrible son, terrible, like a psychopath. So I find interesting that Zeus and Hera, this powerful couple that stays together, has very mediocre children compared to some of Zeus's other children.
Interesting. That's really interesting. And in many ways, it symbolizes that it's really difficult to be stronger than a powerful parent, you know? It's so difficult to be beyond Zeus. And for many sons or daughters who have a really powerful parent, it's so difficult to be beyond their parents, you know? And but Ares is the archetype of war, you know, and passion. And in many ways, he's some kind of lover too, you know? Ares was the god of physical power. Ares, as the god archetype, and man is a stereotype as a masculine image of physical power and movement. A person inclined to intensity and taking action. His heart, mind, and instincts cause him to react quickly with his body without thinking on the consequences. In this way, he is in the other side from Hestia. You know, Hestia is thinking, silence, you know, and Ares is action all the time.
But he's also sort of the worst of the good qualities of his parents, no? His parents are powerful and strong and all this, and he's all of that without control. Mm-hmm. And Hephaestus is the same. It's the best things of his parents without the good ones. It's like he's crafty, he's loyal, he's competent, but he's ugly. And ugliness in the Greek world was terrible. I mean, he's ugly and he has a limp. He's useless. So I think it's very interesting that, like, whoever decided who the children of these two powerful things are made them cripples, because he made the one that was very powerful, very kind of stupid, and the one that was very smart, unlikable by Greek standards.
Exactly.
It's very fascinating.
It's really interesting, you know, Zeus hates Ares, you know?
Yes, because he's the bad child. He's a disappointment, no?
Oh, really disappointment. He was disappointed from Ares and from Hephaestus, you know, because he's so ugly.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean in Roman mythology. I think they ruined this a little bit because Ares, who turns into Mars, has so many of the qualities of Athena.
See?
And so it's too perfect. That would be the child that they should have. They should have Mars. Mm-hmm. But no, the it's more poetic if they have Ares, which is like useless.
Claro.
So, but in art, I want to go back to Hera because like you said, one of the most interesting things about Hera and Zeus together is all the torture that Hera has to survive because Zeus is having so many children and children that he takes care of more than he takes care of her sometimes. But also with the lovers. And I think some of the myths, and this is another important book for mythology that the Romans were really interested in, but Ovid with the Metamorphoses, and this becomes an important theme. I want to talk about Io and Hera. Because this is something also that becomes important in art, is I think artists became, especially graphic artists, became obsessed with metamorphosis because it's so interesting. And I think a lot of metamorphosis in the Greek mythology comes from Hera being angry and from Zeus trying to get away with having sex with a lot of people. In the case of Zeus, the one that I think is represented a lot in art is when he turns himself into a swan to violate, I can't remember who. But with Hera, I think the one that's very interesting is Io, who he, she, anyway, you tell the story with Io and the cow.
Io was a priestess of the goddess Hera in Argos. It's really important, you know, because when Io became as a Zeus lover, it was against Hera too, because she was her priestess, you know, and she was the priestess of the goddess Hera in Argos, and Zeus noticed Io, a mortal woman, and lusted after her. Initially, you know, she rejected Zeus' advances until, you know, the seduction power of Zeus was really strong. And Zeus really enjoyed to stay with Io. And when Hera knew that, she was really, really, really bad. And Zeus decided to transform Io in una ternera.
In a cow, no? Sí.
Exactly. And Hera begged Zeus to give her the heifer as a present, in which, having no reason to refuse, he did, pitying the unfortunate girl, and the Gaia, the goddess of the earth, creates, you know, and the Io, so the cow could eat, thus growing from her, from it was its name. And then...
So the Ionian Ocean is named after Io.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's the thing. There are many versions about Io, you know? It's a Ovid version. Hesiodus talk about her too. Mm-hmm. You know, but the thing is, Hera, you know, wants to be on top of what's happening with that cow, that it's really Io. And
but just to interrupt, like, I think, sorry, not to interrupt, but just one thing that I think is important. Like, this story also reveals how clever Hera is, no? Well, she knows.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like Zeus is like, oh, I'll fool my wife. I just turn her into a cow. And Hera says, that's very strange that my husband is hanging out with a cow.
Exactly.
And tricks him into gifting her a cow, which, and correct me if I'm wrong, but she basically tricks him by basically saying, oh, that's a beautiful cow. And he says, yes, yes, but it's not important. It's just a cow. And she says, oh, since it's just a cow, can I have it? And now he has no way to say, no, it's a very special cow.
Exactly. But she knows, you know, all the time, the archetypes, the female archetypes, the female goddess, usually are more intuitive than the male. The male are, you know, have the authority, have the rationality, but the intuition always have been feminine. And Hera has the intuition, that the reason in to keep, you know, her revenge era, you know, it's all the time around Io, you know, and the only way that Zeus have to, you know, to keep Io with him again is sending Hermes to kill the monster that the Ia, that Hera put around Io to be all the time watching her.
So basically, just Hera takes the cow, which Zeus gives him, gives her, uh-huh. and she basically has no intention of ever letting her become Io again, and puts her under the care of Argus, no?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's called Argus Panoptes.
And no? He has it a thousand eyes?
Yeah. It was a giant who had 100 eyes or something like that to watch Io and prevent Zeus from visiting her. Mm. And so Zeus sent Hermes to distract and eventually slay Argus.
Yes.
And there are many versions. But according to one version, he did so by first luring him to sleep by playing music and telling stories. Zeus freed Io, is still in the form of a heifer. In some myths, Hera used Argus' eyes to decorate her peacock's feathers to thank the giant for his help.
Right, so when Hermes decapitates him in order to keep Argus as a thank you, that's why the peacock has the eyes. That's the theory.
Yeah, and the peacock is the symbol of Hera.
Right. And then Hermes, I think another thing that's interesting about that story with Argus, like you said, like the way he makes him fall asleep is by telling a story and lulling him and using his brain. In many ways, I've always thought that this is also kind of the precursor to something like Scheherazade. This idea that you can outwit a bigger enemy with knowledge or with cunning, which Hermes was kind of cunning, como Loki or something like that in other mythology.
Exactly.
But we see this again. I think Scheherazade always reminded me of this story. Like, oh, I'm going to die. This is a bigger enemy. I'm going to just bore him to death, basically. But this is not the end for Io's torment, no? Doesn't Io still have to go around the earth after this?
Yeah, she's still going. There are many versions, you know? There are many versions. In the version of the story in which Zeus transformed Io, the deception failed and Hera begged Zeus to give her the heifer as a present. And Zeus freed Io, still in the form of heifer, in some myths, in order to exact her revenge. Hera sent a gadfly to steering Io continuously, driving her to wander the world without rest. Io eventually crossed the path between the Propontis and the Black Sea, you know, which was acquired the name Bosphorus, donde está Istanbul, más o menos.
Yeah, like near Bosphorus. Turkey. So she wanders until she finds Turkey. But I just want something you said just to clarify. What she's saying, which I love about this story, is the explanation of why there are flies around cows is that Hera is so petty and she hates Io so much that she gives her flies because they're so annoying, which is amazing. I mean, I think it's so funny.
There are many stories with that flies.
But this is a story that we see a lot, but I also, beyond the story that you see, because you see this depicted in a lot of art, the Io. So if you ever see a cow and a weird man with a beard and a weird lady, it's probably Io in a museum. But besides that, I think it's a prototype of, like I said, the metamorphosis, which is something that we're going to see a lot. And I think this is one of the first metamorphoses I read, because, like you said, the Theogony goes through the origin of the cosmos, and then immediately the work of Days, which is the next Homeric hymn, is about metamorphosis and a lot of things. So I like this myth to explain something that we're going to see again, especially in later chapters when we talk about the second generation of Olympians, because it becomes so important in the second generation of Olympians. I think metamorphosis is important for the first generation of Olympians, and you correct me if I'm wrong, mostly for Zeus to have sex with things. But the second generation of Olympians, it becomes a tool to explain nature. Why is this flower here? Why is this tree here? Why is the mountain? And often metamorphosis will be the explanation.
Exactly. And the metamorphosis is late mythology, you know, because it's a Latin mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And they took the Greek mythology and reinterpreted since a different perspective, point of view, but yes, it's a continuation of the explanation, the relation humans with nature.
Yeah, and like very normal things, like we said, like Io also works to explain why there are flies around cows. It's mm-hmm. not, and I think there's so much creativity here because it's not something that needs an explanation, you know?
Exactly.
And yet the Greeks decided to create this whole story with these gods they had about why there would be flies around cows. And I think that that's, again, if we're talking about why artists find so much enjoyment in Greek mythology, it's because of this creativity. I think more than any mythology, except the Norse gods also have a lot of this. But I think the Greeks even more, no?
Yeah, it's interesting because most of these myths are explaining the astonishment with nature. You know, it's not the explanation about why this exists. All the myths are an expression of astonishment
mm-hmm.
with nature.
Yes.
More than an explanation. Myths never pretend to be rational explanations, you know?
Pero they're beautiful, no? And I think that that's what makes it interesting, that it's like, oh, there must be a really cool explanation to why there's flies around the cow.
Yeah, it's an explanation, mm-hmm. but related with astonishment.
Yes.
You know? Wow.
But yeah, you're also elevated, in what you're saying, that astonishment is also, this is also, Greeks are very irrational, especially in the Olympic period. Like, the greatest thing you can do for a phenomenon of nature is to tie it to the gods not so much just entertainment, but in a logical way. It's like, oh, uh-huh. like the cow did something wrong and that's why it deserves a fly. There's a logic explanation to why, and we're going to make it up, you know? And I like that so much about metamorphosis specifically, which I think we'll talk uh-huh. more later. But I think we've done like an hour and a half, so let's call this an episode. But before we go away, let's just make a quick review of some of the symbology that people can run into, and that to be the takeaway of this episode. So I'll start with just the gods. If you see a trident, it's usually Poseidon. Hades is represented by a helmet a lot of the time, but his representations are not very clear, no? Zeus by obviously the thunder, Hera by everything related to commitment and weddings, and Hestia, is it fire or what is it that represents Hestia?
It's the fire.
In art, fire. So, I think anything else you want to say before of this first generation and the
yes,
chaos and everything?
Zeus is also the eagle.
Ah, yes, the eagle.
And it's interesting because there are many gods from ancient Near East who are related with eagle, you know? The gods from heaven are related with eagle.
Wait, it's interesting because the eagle's not a nice bird, no?
But it's powerful.
Very powerful, but it's not nice.
But who cares to be nice? That you're Christian.
No, no, that's what I'm saying. That it's very, I like that. I like that. That's something I love about, like I told you, Greek mythology, that it's, in a way, it's impersonal.
Yeah, yeah. No, the eagle is powerful, you know, and that's what they want to show. They relate animals with gods because the reason were their powers, you know? And the eagle is the king of heaven.
Yes. So I think for next time we get together, we will talk about the second generation of Olympians, who are my favorite.
Okay.
I don't know if we do this next time or when we finally start talking about humans, but we will have to go back in time to talk about Prometheus.
Okay.
And three figures that we mentioned, but I think are fascinating, and then we will find again in Shakespeare as the witch, and in many places, which are the Fates, which I love how they operate, but that's for next time.
Okay. But before we end,
yes,
I want to say something about you, you know, and it's, she was related with Prometheus, mm-hmm. you know, and Prometheus made a prophecy. And, you know, eels were around the mount where Prometheus was chained. And Iotus met chained Prometheus during her journey, who gave her comfort. He predicted that one day Io would take back her human form, bear children from Zeus, and one of her descendants would be come to free Prometheus from his torture. After many years of wandering, Io eventually reached Egypt, where Zeus gave her back her human form. Io bore a son, Epaphus, and daughter, Caressa, from Zeus. According to mythology, Epaphus later founded the town of Memphis in Egypt, which he named after his wife. Caressa met him with sea god Poseidon and gave birth to a son, Byzas, who would later found the town of Byzantium, now known as Constantinople. And it's interesting because, you know, all the myths are connected, you know, are not just for one moment in time. He eventually married Telogonus, the king of Egypt, and the grandson Danaus would return to Greece with his 50 daughters, the Danaides. 11 generations afterwards, one of Io's descendants, the legendary Hercules, will set Prometheus free from his chains. The descendants of Io will also make the royal houses of Thebes and Argos.
I'm very glad you brought that up, because I think that the other reason to do this, what you said is so important. Everything's connected in the Greek world. And some of the best works are not related directly to these gods. I think that there are some treatments of Apollo. There are some treatments of, Apollo is the big one. There are some musical, for example, treatments of Apollo, or he appears in a play. But the big plays that are more interesting, for example, Aeneas, like from the Aeneid, there's a lot of treatment of him. And you can't get to that without all of this, because, like you said, it's all connected. The Aeneid only exists so that the Romans could claim that they were also very, very cool like the Greeks. And so, like you said, it's fascinating because it's connected, but that's why we have to start here with these. I don't think that they're the most interesting, except for Zeus and Hera. Poseidon, I don't find that interesting. He's very interesting in the Iliad, but that's about it. Hades is just Hades, but you can't understand the human part of it, the Hercules and Achilles, without understanding all of the relationships between their great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers, who are the Olympians, and why they're so worried about everything. So that's what we have in store for however many of these we end up doing. So, gracias.
Oh, a ti.
No, muy chévere. Entonces.